Golly, that's one of my favorite songs. I like to sing that song, and that and along with Cocaine Blues. Yeah, I sang that song before about 200 people on Friday night. No, Saturday night. Yeah, I go around and sing a little bit. They even got my posters up on the wall of when I sang in San Diego. And we're not rejected everywhere we go. Man, come on. This is White Aryan Resistance Radio. White Aryan Resistance Radio Network, right here in Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. You know, it's snowed all night, but not too bad. We've only got about 3 or 4 inches out there, but it's cold and it's wet. How about that? Hey, we've got our website partially up now. Yeah, I think the front page and some other stuff is up there, and the webmaster is working her tail off getting it up there, and so pretty soon we'll be back in business, much to the chagrin of those who can't stand us. Morris D's and the right wing too, you know, isn't that son of a bitch ever going to die? Well, I was on the phone this morning with some legislators. I never got to any legislators. I got to their rinky-dink assistants that didn't know shit about anything down in the State House here in Indiana on this so-called hate crimes bill. In a Senate Bill 220. They got it through the Senate. Now they got to get it through the House. I don't think it's getting too much resistance. It had gotten quite a bit of resistance up until this year. But the what's really driving it now is not so much the black situation. It's the homosexual and the trisexual and bisexual and LGBT and XYZ and all of those people are really pushing it hard. You know what's funny? In the city, where a lot of these different types of aberrations occur, guess who's going to get the shit beat out of them? Yeah, I guess who's going to go to jail? The blacks are going to go to jail for a hate crime against the LGBTs and back and forth. And what if the homosexual gets the big fist fight with a black, and then they're both charged with a hate crime? This is going to get interesting. I sent you out a letter I sent to the local fish wrap today, explaining to them it is not going to solve a problem, it's going to make it worse. Because I said, I guarantee you, most guys that go to jail or prison for extra time because of so-called hate crime, they're going to come out a lot more pissed off than when they went in. But I said, since you don't listen to me anyhow, you're just going to have to suffer. So anyhow, I'm going to keep riding my state senator a little bit. He ain't got to do anything about it, but... Because the fix is in. You know, once the fix is in, the fix is in. Anyhow, it's, like I say, mostly the other extremes that are promoting this and pushing it hard. And also, I told him, I said, look, guys, I was there at the hearing in California, Los Angeles, when they were having Senate hearings in California on the hate crime bill. I was there to testify, and I did testify. And one fellow that testified was one of our old Klan members. Yeah, Greg Withrow. And he ran the youth group up at the college in Red River or something, Sacramento, California. Well, he got back into drugs and got off the racial program. And then one night, he claimed that someone kidnapped him. He was inferring it was our guys, my guys, kidnapped him and nailed him to a board, nailed him to a cross like Jesus in downtown Sacramento, which the chief of police investigated. The chief of police was pretty corrupt in Sacramento, but he wasn't that corrupt. He said, bullshit, this never happened. So the hate crime bill in California was passed mainly on his testimony, even though that fake story went worldwide. It was everywhere. You probably heard it. He was even on television. I even debated a guy on television, national television, that it never happened. So that's the way it goes. They're just going to, you're going to have more and more people claim they've had a hate crime. You know, there's been hundreds of them and hundreds of Jews who have claimed they've had a hate crime against them. One Jew will slap a swastika on his neighbor's house and all that kind of stuff. In fact, there's a book written by a guy in Kansas City, the college. I forget which college, but anyhow, it's out there on all the fake hate crime laws around. So anyhow, they're at it again, boys. In fact, I called everybody, including writing the paper. I said, look, when are they going to come up with an addition to the law that protects white heterosexual working class males? Are you telling me nobody hates white working class males or any white working class males? Well, I can name me a few within a half a mile that hate my ass. And I got no protection at all. Except, you know, maybe they'll get somebody with an unauthorized attack or something like that. What do you call it? On the street? Yeah, it's the way in California. If you attack a Mexican and you say you're dirty Mexican or something like that, that's automatically a hate crime. But when the Mexican attacks you, that's simply simple assault. Yeah, that's the way that works. If a nigger attacks you, it's assault. If you attack the nigger and they can prove any way you were racial, or if you said nigger, you're going to get it. So when they say that they're really not out after the white man, that's a perfect example. They're goddamn liars. They lie through their teeth. Of course, the rich ruling class, they don't give a shit because they can get out of it, you know. They don't even have to be around the niggers if they don't want to, except the ones they pay off and the nigger whores, you know. Sometimes they beat up on a nigger whore and they get them for something, but they usually never go away for a hate crime. They never do. Yeah. You know, this morning a little bit, I was listening to this black guy, Joe Madison, who's pretty funny because he gives the blacks all kinds of hell. And if they interrupt, he climbs all over them and everything. He, actually, worse than most white racists. But I sent him an email, and I said, you know, you were talking about the cops leaning on the blacks, especially the Panthers and so forth, up in San Francisco and L.A. And I said, well, I'm very familiar with that. And I said, there's a book you need to pick up called the Glass House Tapes, paperback. I can probably still get it. The Glass House Tapes, that describes all that stuff where the cops were setting up the blacks, black militants, San Francisco and L.A. I knew all about it. That was my job, to know what was going on. I said, well, I want to tell you another story. My friend George Lincoln Rockwell, the commander of the National Socialist Party, white people's party, he had a crew there in Oakland, California, during the time that the Panthers were running around, because this guy was bragging about how great the Panthers were. Well, anyhow, I said they had about seven guys there living in Oakland. They lived in a second-story apartment, and they flew a swastika out the window of their building, right in the middle of nigger Oakland. Nobody ever attacked them. Nobody ever even gave them any trouble. So one time they decided Huey Newton, the head of the Panthers, was getting a little out of his class. They went over to the headquarters and stood out front with guns drawn. I mean guns, real guns, loaded guns. And said, Huey, it's your friendly National Nazi Party here. Come on out. And there was a little timid voice come out of the building, says, we ain't coming out. We got no quarrel with you. So the Nazis went back home. Well, that's a story that I've told before, but there's a lot of stories that you're not going to hear from any of these other right-wingers, because most of them were too damn young to know about it. Just like when Rockwell and the boys went down on the docks and had a riot with the red laborers. There was a lot of reds down there on the docks. And my friend Donald Musgrove, who was my advisor, he was a jailhouse lawyer. He picked up a guy and threw him through a plate glass window. And he was only about 110 pounds, and he was sick, too. But he was defending George Lincoln Rockwell, so he wasn't going to let anybody hurt George Lincoln Rockwell. He picked this son of a bitch up, threw him right through a plate glass window, and there's anybody that doubts it could go into the morgue of the San Francisco newspapers, and there's a big picture of it from back in the 60s. Yeah, so anyhow, there's another little story. I better tell these stories that I know before Broomhilda comes down here and picks me up and takes me off to Valhalla. So anyhow, you younger guys need to know these stories because, you know, there really were men involved even in the right wing back then. Tough guys, rough guys, kick-ass guys that would go into the streets and fight, you know, 20, 30, 40 times the number of people in the streets. Even I've done that, and I'm just a little guy. One thing that made us pretty effective was we trained these guys in the Roman diamond formation and the Roman V. where you put your men in a symbol like a diamond, just like they do in the military, where you have a point man, you have a guy on the right, guy on the left with BARs, automatic rifles, or something like that, and the guy on the back with some kind of weaponry, and you march forward, you're sort of like a human tank. Well, you can do that in a riot situation. The cops do it all the time. You make a formation like a diamond and go forward, even if you've only got baseball bats or something like that, and it works. You can plow through 200 people with no problem if you really got stand-up guys. Now, just anybody can't do that because not too many people got the guts to even try it. But the V formation is also good. And so think of that. If you got to get out of a place and you got a few people, you can make those formations and fight your way out pretty handily. Yeah. Anyhow, so they're going to pass a hate crimes law here in Indiana, which is going to mean there's going to be a lot more white racists in the prisons, which will mean a lot more white racists writing me for information and passing it along. And some of them may be pretty good people. Well, I think I cut off my... Well, no, I didn't. I thought I cut off my program there, but I still got it. Let's find out a little bit about war corresponding, which you know about that a little bit, I bet.
Georgia's chance came with the arrival of the American Expeditionary Forces, led by General John J. Pershing.
And when Pershing came over, he started a press section, and so I thought that would be the place for me, and I came there, and I was made a captain in the Army.
One of the first things that happens to a war correspondent when he becomes accredited is he's given a uniform to wear, an officer's uniform. The reason for this is to make the correspondent feel a sense of identity with the Army he's about to report on. He has the privileges of an officer. He's expected to mix with officers. He's expected to regard the efforts of the Army with the same sympathy as an officer would. And once that sense of identity develops, then he's already on the way to writing the sort of propaganda that the military wants him to write.
Few of us question this world struggle. We believed in the personal devil theory of history. The Kaiser was the great villain. This was the usual biblical conflict between good and evil. We were fighting for peace, and we'd get it by the sword.
Like all correspondents, the Americans went for the glory of war rather than the horror. The stories they wrote were generally ones of cheerful GIs going into battle, winning medals, helping their French counterparts, helping their British counterparts, glorying and actually enjoying the combat.
There were exceptions to the glowing reports. Haywood Bruin of the New York Tribune exposed a massive supply scandal that had hindered American troops since they first landed. A furious General Pershing stripped Bruin of his accreditation. He told the remaining press corps that such unpatriotic reporting undermined the war effort and would not be tolerated.
The military view of the role of the war correspondent is simply that he is there to help victory, and he should not write anything that might in any way hamper the early victory of his own side. Now, I think you can argue that in a war of national survival, but in a war when your own nation's future is not at risk, then I think you owe a duty to your reader to describe succinctly and accurately and vividly what war is all about. Otherwise, what is your role as a reporter?
It was not war, but peace, that led George Seldes to re-examine his role.
After the armistice had been signed, it was against the law, the military law at the time, to go behind German lines. Now, George Seldes and three others simply ignored this.
Here we were just sitting around, and I don't know who it was said, well, this armistice doesn't apply to us, you know. None. Censorship and rules never apply to newspaper people. let's drive the cars through Luxembourg and just afterwards report that we just lost our way.
We drove into terrain which a few hours before had been a battlefield. In that scene of peace and beauty, the torn and twisted bodies of human beings seemed so shockingly out of place.
We all shook hands and said, let's take an oath that the rest of our lives will be devoted to telling the truth and the whole truth about what wars are like, and instead of writing these glorious stories that we've been writing up to now. And after all, war is murder, you know.
For 3 days, the reporters roamed the devastated German countryside. They saw popular revolts. They interviewed generals. But it was retreating German soldiers who made the strongest impression.
They were rather simple youths and middle-aged men who did not know much about the war or why they were in it, and who were happy it was over, although regretting defeat. They gave us food and talked sympathetically. All the hate I felt for the Germans disappeared during those 72 hours.
When we got back, there was a movement made to enforce the armistice law, which says that anyone violating the armistice, either side crossing the lines, their commander-in-chief could have them court-martialed, and if found guilty, the penalty would be death by a firing squad.
Pershing told the reporters they could avoid court-martial only if they agreed to write nothing about their journey, nothing that would humanize the defeated German enemy.
The armistice liberated our minds. Suddenly we were able to question what we had seen. But I never wrote a word about the biggest adventure of my life while it was news.
Yeah, these war capitalists don't want you to see the blood and guts if they can keep it quiet, keep it secret if they can. But I think that the American people watching the news should get the whole gory mess every night. Whether that'll wake them up or not, I don't know. Probably not, because they seem to really wallow around in the gory parts of war and make a hell of a lot of movies about it. It's wonderful. Go over there and kill somebody. And I've met guys like that were born killers, and they lived to kill, and they could go in the military and get away with it. In civilian life, they wouldn't last long. Well, here's an interesting little item from the Jews, from the Hebrews. Actually, almost none of them could possibly be true Hebrews. What is the point of building so many Jewish museums? There are more of them in the world than you might think. Hundreds, possibly more than 1,000, even if we don't count the ones in Israel. The real question is why Jews build so many when so few people visit them. Mostly goyim, mostly Christian whites. This is not a question that Edward Rothstein addresses in his sweeping and persuasive examination of, quote, the problem with Jewish museums, unquote, but it's one that began to intrigue me as I had the opportunity to visit scores of such museums. This was from the writer. To be sure, there are Jewish museums like the Anne Frank House in Amsterdam and Washington's Holocaust Memorial Museum, both dealt with by Rothstein, where tourists must wait in line to enter. But even at major institutions like the Musée d'Art Historique du Judaism in Paris, however that's pronounced, or for that matter, the Philadelphia National Museum of American Jewish History, you're likely to find yourself alone in the galleries. Nobody there. visit the St. John Jewish Historical Museum in New Brunswick or the Jewish Museum of Wodalia in eastern Poland, and I guarantee you'll have solitude. You've probably never heard of the Jewish Museum of Maine. It was created to save an old synagogue in Portland from crumbling into despair, which may be the most common reason for founding a Jewish museum. The loving, restored building, one of the oldest remaining European-style synagogues in continuous use in Maine, unquote, continues to house prayer services, to host communal events, and to welcome visitors to rotating art exhibitions on the main floor, as well as a surprisingly poignant exhibition about the history of the Jews in Maine in the upstairs gallery. And then there are the many local Holocaust museums around the country, thanks to, what was his name up there in Skokie, in Chicago, Frank Cohen, who caused that Holocaust museum to be built up there. If he hadn't said he's going to go in and march around in Skokie, there never would have been a museum there. So be careful what you pray for. The Florida Holocaust Museum in St. Petersburg on Florida's less Jewish West Coast is a large, highly professional institution created by two people who escaped the Shoah, met, married, and built a successful life in America, and founded this museum to prevent future genocides. How in the hell is that going to prevent future genocides? By teaching the members of all races and cultures the inherent worth and dignity of human life. Well, we've learned over and over that there is no dignity of human life, or very little. They kill them by the hundreds of thousands and millions. And then they say, I'm sorry, and they build a museum, whether it's for Arabs or Indians or whoever it may be. You know, one thing about that Holocaust Museum in Skokie, Illinois, see, Frank Cohen was a Nazi Jew. And I think the whole thing was designed to get them a museum in Skokie. Because they never marched in Skokie. The Nazis never marched in Skokie. They were going to. They said they were going to, but they never did. But out of it came this museum, and out of it came the understanding that Frank Collin, Harold Covington's butt buddy, was a Jew. And, of course, Covington slept in the same bedroom and maybe in the same bed, could never figure out he was a Jew. I saw him one time on TV. It said, that son of a bitch is a Jew. And then there are the many local Holocaust museums around the country. The Florida Holocaust Museum in St. Petersburg on Florida's less Jewish West Coast is a large, highly professional institution created by two people who escaped. Oh, well, I read that before. Florida's more Jewish Southeast Coast, a Holocaust museum scheduled to open in Hollywood, Florida this summer, intends to illuminate the catastrophic ramifications of prejudice, racism, stereotyping, and bullying. As if the Jews are not stereotyping and bullying Palestinians. You know, George Carlin, he's got to be the rightest guy that has lived in a long time, and now he's dead, because it's every time he says that, it's all bullshit, folks. I say, amen, amen. The apparent inability or unwillingness of Holocaust museums to address the uniqueness of anti-Semitism, which Rothstein analyzes so well, is a problem, and is not the only problem. If it's legitimate to ask what motivates Jews to build so many museums, it is sometimes also necessary to ask what makes a museum Jewish. New York's Jewish Museum traces its collection to a small trove of Judaica given to the Jewish Theological Seminary by Judge Meir Sulzberger in 1904. 4 decades later, the collection moved to the Warburg Mansion on Fifth Avenue when that family gave their building as a permanent home for a Jewish museum. If you don't know about the Warburgs, you better study them. They were the big banking family. And they said, in the history books, they say this poor little persecuted Jew, Warburg, came over here with nothing but a suitcase. What they don't tell you is the suitcase was full of money. Today, the museum maintains two top-notch gift shops filled with Judaica and Jewish exhibits on the upper floors. But finding the Jewish connection in the art exhibitions that usually fill the museum's main galleries is like a game of Where's Waldo, with the clue usually being that at least one of the artists is of Jewish descent, whatever that is, if they could trace those genetics. I want to see him do DNA on a Jew and have it come up Jew. It's never going to come up Jew because they're not a race. A similar situation exists with the art displayed at the Contemporary Jewish Museum in San Francisco, housed in an old power station dramatically renovated by Daniel Libeskind. Still, to me, the real conundrum is how the museum sponsors, many of whom descended from families that made their fortunes in the gold rush, probably running general stores selling eggs for $50 a piece, and were founding members of the San Francisco Historic Reform Congregations, have retained. Anyhow, can you imagine those Jews out there digging in the rocks and in the cold and the snow and everything for gold? Bullshit. That's like the joke about the guy rubs a bottle and the genie comes out. And I see a black guy comes along and he says, "Well, what do you want?" And the black guy says, I want $1 million. So, woof, he gives him $1 million. He takes off, and a Jew comes along. He says, rubs the deal, and the genie comes out. "What do you want?" He says, "I want to just have the map and the directions of which way that nigger went." Like other San Francisco families whose ancestors struck it rich in the gold rush. Yeah, right. They stole the gold from the guys who did work for it. These Jewish scions of American wealth support a wide range of cultural institutions. Well, if you make enough money, you can give a little back and claim you're a wonderful guy. People do that all the time. Aryan crooks do the same thing, you know. Who was it? I'm trying to think of one that did that. Henry Ford did it. After they machine gunned down the workers out west and are educated and live just to do their non-Jewish peers. The museum they built needs explaining because I know of no effort to build a $47.5 million contemporary Irish museum in downtown San Francisco and fill it with works of arts of Irish ancestry. Well, hell no, we'll never do that. That might piss off the Brits. And that brings me back to my theme. The mere fact that so many of these institutions exist of all kinds and stripes is surely an indication of something, some enduring particle of sentiment, if not of identity, that is peculiar to American Jews. After all, a National Irish American Museum has been proposed but not built. The Armenian Genocide Museum of America got as far as a contract to purchase a handsome old building near the White House, but the committee had to relinquish the project for lack of funds. Well, they probably couldn't borrow any money from the Jews. Jewish museums, by contrast, outnumber those built by any other American identity group, with the probable exception of African American museums, which the Jews had to loan them money to build those. It seems to me that at work in all these cases, but especially in the case of the smaller but far more numerous museums, is some deeply felt need to commemorate a way of life that the founders regard as irretrievably lost, because almost all of them are built and supported by communities rather than individuals. They're also constrained by the need to tell the consensus story, a story of Jews in America that ended with photos of two men being married under a hip huppah by a female rabbi. Yeah. Or, I like this Jew. Or, contrarily, with images of smiling sons and daughters joyfully embarked on Aliyah, would elicit objection from one quarter or another. By the same token, exhibits undertaking a truly serious exploration of the past, present, or future risk, opening communal fissures that have to be ignored in assembling the funds that will turn an old immigrant shoal into the Jewish Museum of Maryland or the Jewish History Museum of Tucson, Arizona. Well, that brings me to one thing to remind you, something the right wing never seems to understand. Jews fight among themselves like you wouldn't believe. They murder each other. They kill each other. They rape each other's wives and do all the things that anybody else has ever been accused of. But, you know, the right wing says the Jews are totally all together and there's no way of fighting the Jews because they control everything and we control nothing. And that's just bullshit. Of course it is. Curiously enough, however, the narrow focus of such small Jewish museums, the particularisms of Jewish Refugees Museum in Shanghai, of the Kahila Kadasha Janina Museum on New York's Lower East Side, or of the National Museum of American Jewish Military History in Washington, D.C., I don't think that's a very big one, gives them a power that the Panoramic American Museum of Jewish History in Philadelphia utterly lacks. As Rothstein acidly points out, in spite of that narrow focus, or rather because of it, small Jewish museums are endlessly fascinating. They touch the heart because they express the determination of a small group of Jews to preserve and celebrate a community, you know, like nobody else does that, or an aspect of Jewish life where more often than not there is little such life at present. It's gone. It's in the past. And the stories they tell, after all, are of a time when Jewishness had palpability, content. Before there was Israel, you know, like I'm telling you, before there was Israel, the Jews were far more powerful. And the Orthodox are right about that. They're getting weaker and weaker as Israel gets stronger and stronger. Okay, there was something else I wanted to say, and I forget what it was. Actually, all cultures do this. When they're in decline, they build their biggest monuments. In India, when the Brits were on their way out, they were building their biggest monuments. So when you're culture starts building bigger and bigger monuments, and I think we're doing that here, it means you're on the way out, not the way in. Okay, let's see here. We got more here. Wait a minute. Well, I slipped here and moved past where I was at, so we're going to try to pick up where I was at here. This is an interesting article. But this is extravagantly unlike any other kind of American identity museum. Within such a museum of hyphenated identity, the accent falls on the term before the hyphen, emphasizing the Chinese, the Indian, the Arab, the black, de-emphasizing, if not devaluing, the American. In Jewish museums, the emphasis shifts in the other direction. Despite the presence of discrimination and hardship in America, and the American promise are decisive factors. Well, a certain segment of the Jews never had a hard time in this country. Don't let them bullshit you. There were a number of them, working class Jews. They weren't treated any better and sometimes worse than Aryans. So, and they still are. so far so good that that's not the only contrast between two types. Unfortunately, as faithful and historically accurate as Jewish museums might be to the promise of American democracy, they simultaneously tend to turn to a peculiar blind eye to the promise and the substance of Jewish identity itself. That is the second and deeply problematic contrast, one that would seem to call into question the very purpose of the Identity Museum itself. As faithful as Jewish museums might be to the promise of America, they tend to turn a peculiar blind eye to the promise and the substance of Jewish identity itself. I read that before. In the case of most minorities, to judge by the story told in identity museums, the freedom gained in the United States has been the freedom to become most like themselves. For their part, many Jewish American museums are more preoccupied with the freedom of Jews to become American than the freedom of Jews to remain fully Jewish. In fact, there is often a suggestion that exercising the former freedom is precisely how Jewish Americans are most true to their identity. Well, successful Jews know that it is capitalism and the money business that makes them strong. Nothing else. Their religion don't give them that much strength. But they learned early on in history, you control the money. Control the money, that's what they're into. Now, this is a very interesting article, and it goes on and on for quite a ways. I'm not going to do the whole thing. But it's amazing to me that the right wing, of which I was part of, did not figure out a lot of this stuff beforehand. And I'm sure some individuals did, but they have this almost Jewish fascination with Jews. That the Jews run everything, and, well, sure they ran Hollywood, but they didn't start by running Hollywood. The Aryans ran Hollywood, and they allowed the Jews to muscle in with their money and so forth. Just like organized crime, got started with a lot of Italians and Irish, but who moved in? The Jews. Well, that's because they're good at it. That's how they did it. And another thing, just remember, it was the ruling class that passed on anti-Semitism about the Jews. The working class didn't have the power. Well, they trickled down from the ruling class and sort of winked and looked the other way when the working class became more anti-Jew. But before that, they were anti-Irish, they were anti-you name it. So that's the situation there. If you want to pin the tail on the donkey, you go to the ruling class who really pushed anti-Semitism as a defense to their money power. Most of it was, yeah. Anyhow, if you want to read more of this tell-all stuff that the Jews tell on themselves, they tell a lot of good, juicy stuff about themselves. Go to, this is Mosaic, MOSAIC.com. And you can read the rest of that article, and they have a lot of very exposing articles about Jews. You don't have to go to some Nazi magazine to get it. You can get it right from the horse's mouth. Well, did you know that Malaysia is one of the world's most anti-Jewish countries? According to a 2014 survey by the Anti-Defecation League, 60% of Malaysians hold anti-Jew beliefs, the highest proportion of any country in Asia outside the Middle East. Hatred of Jews also figures prominently in the Malaysian political discourse, rearing its head most recently in the context of corruption scandal now rocking the country. Anti-Jewish prejudice in Malaysia did not develop in response to the tiny population of Jews who lived there, but instead by tuned to the frequencies of the Muslim world and saw the rise of Israel. And, see, here I go again. The Jews, the Jews congregate together in one country, and of course the United States is powerful, and so all the hatred towards the United States and Israel spreads around the world, and the anti-Jewry comes up all over the place. The Jews are great at shooting themselves in the foot. Okay, where was I? It had to do with the subjugation of the Palestinians. As the religion's great humiliation, now commonplace in Malaysia, is the idea that Jews are using rival political parties as proxies to dismantle the Muslim Malaysian state. So now they've got everybody believing the other section, the other party, is infiltrated by the Jews. They do that here too. There are strong similarities between the prejudice that Jews faced in Europe and the one faced in ethnic Chinese throughout Southeast Asia. Well, most of that anti-Jewishness in Europe came about by the Catholic Church and Christian religion and the Eastern Orthodox Church. Simple as that. I don't think it came that much from the average non-religious person. In both cases, heightened senses of nationalism in host countries in the 20th century led to the systematic persecution of the entrepreneurial minority. Yeah. In other words, a small group that disproportionately controlled too much money, based on accusations that the minority was abusing its host country's generosity and exploiting locals for its community's own benefits. Well, of course it does. Sure they do. And there's others that do it, but the Jews seem to be more effective at it. Okay, let's move on. I'm getting tired of talking about the Jews. One last thing about the Jews. Will Israel's natural gas fields ever get developed? Tens of trillions of cubic feet of gas lie waiting offshore with the potential to transform the world's energy map and perhaps even stabilize the Middle East. Why? They fight among themselves too much. Read the Israeli news, how they're all fighting over this gas deal. I don't think they'll ever get it opened up. Then they want to sell the gas to Turkey, and Turkey will sell it back to ISIS, and then ISIS will bomb Jews. What a wacky world. It's all bullshit. Well, I don't watch Niggerball, but I guess there's a big row about the Super Bowl. When Beyonce dropped Formation out of the blue on Saturday, the internet predictably lost its shit. This has become the standard practice anytime Bey releases a new work, which I don't understand any of this. But Saturday was different. The Formation is a big deal, not simply because it is a new Beyonce song that exists, but because a song about Beyonce's blackness. The track highlights her southern roots, draws on the strength of her ancestors, and wills that empowerment on her daughter. Blue Ivy. And it comes at a time when frustration at unfair policies and policing practices that disproportionately affect people of color has spread across the country. So far, I haven't understood a goddamn thing it says. Beyonce didn't sanitize the Formation's Afrocentrism the next day when she performed it in a black and gold leather militant costume in front of an audience of millions. Her onstage clique was made up of 30 black women, their curly afros topping their with berets, dressed in Black Panther regalia. The women's movements blended physical finesse with revolutionary symbolism. Yeah, they didn't have any machetes. Switching from hip jerks to raised fists with synchronicity, that suggests it's all from the same ancestral power. Yeah, jungle power. This was a peak in a show that included a thrilling trade-off with Bruno Mars. Yeah, I know him from on the radio. It was almost as if they didn't even invite Coldplay, technically the headlining act, to rehearsals. I'm not going to go ahead with this because it don't make sense to me, and it's all screwy nigger stuff. And now they're all fighting about that. I see the Screenwriters Guild have to do a one-upmanship on the Oscars. So they appointed at least two pretty much black movies to be nominated for their Screen Directors Award. Neither one of them won anyhow, so I don't know. You got to have a black separate deal. You got to have separate black movies and separate black awards and all that. But they know they couldn't get any white people to finance it. And they couldn't get any rich black people to finance it either, because rich black people don't like to watch black shit. They want to watch white shit or Jewish stuff. Well, I see a Chicago cop is suing the family of a black teenager he killed over emotional trauma. Well, that's interesting. That's really interesting. There's a little bit more of this Super Bowl crap. The statement comes almost a year after Kendrick Lamar revealed the cover for To Pimp a Butterfly, featuring a family of black men and boys posing with stacks of cash in hand and standing over an incapacitated white judge. The message was clear: we're taking back what's ours. It's an important message, but the lack of women in the tableau is glaring and not unique to the broader history of the struggle for civil rights. The Black Panther Party was made up primarily of men when it was founded in 1966. I remember them well, but evolved into a female majority by the early 70s, according to Stanley Nelson Jr., director of the Black Panthers' Vanguard of the Revolution. And yet to be penist remembering of history has pushed the outsized role of male revolutionaries as canon. Even the movement itself relegated women to the periphery. Talk about revolution. They're not going to be that revolution because they're too busy fighting among themselves. Well, tonight's the big dog and pony show in New Hampshire. All the bullshit and all the... We love the American people, and if you'll just make me your master, I'll straighten everything out. Well, I just hope Trump raises hell because he's a lot of fun to watch. Other than that, forget it. It says here terrorist groups and lone wolves might make life very uncomfortable for us. Not me, because I am a lone wolf. But the thought of America turning into an Islamic society is difficult to entertain. I don't think it'd be that much worse than crazy Christianity and Judaism. But is it really so far-fetched? No, it's obviously coming right around the corner. Some places in Europe, Parisian suburbs, areas of Brussels, all of Sweden, are well on their way to Islamization. In other words, non-whites. But the possibility of this could happen in America may seem remote. Our Muslim population is small, and the Middle East is oceans away. Our military is powerful, but they can't beat ISIS. And our police are well trained. Yeah, right. Terrorist groups and lone wolves might make life very uncomfortable for us, but the thought of America turning into an Islamic society is difficult to entertain. Still, it's worth contemplating the unthinkable, if for no other reason than the same thought was also unthinkable in Europe a couple of decades ago. But a lot of Europeans are contemplating an Islamic Europe now. Why? Because they didn't do anything to stop it. Now they're whining about it. Just like they'll whine here, whine till the bitter end. Some of the hottest selling books on the continent are focused on just that prospect. Theo Sarrazin's Germany is abolishing itself. Merkel is abolishing Germany. She's a false flag. Elena Chertova's Mosque of Notre Dame and Michelle Hollebeck's Submission is to name a few books. Europe's path to submission is paved with large-scale Muslim immigration. high birth rates for Muslims in conversations. 7 years ago, Mark Stein provided a glimpse of how the last factor might be played out. Quote, let's say you work in an office in those cities. One day they install a Muslim prayer room and a few folks head off to the designated time while the rest of you get on with what passes for work in the EU. A couple of years go by and it's now a few more folks scooting off to the prayer room. Then it's a majority, and the ones who don't are beginning to feel a bit awkward about being left behind. What do? The future showed up a lot sooner than you thought. If you, the average post-Christian Euro-secularist, what's the big deal? Who wants to be the last guy sitting in the office sharpening his pencil during morning prayers? Well, if you want to stop it, you stop it. And don't tell me you don't know how to stop it. You don't know how to come together and stop it. Well, if you don't know how to stop it, then you're going to be destined to get it in the ass. Even the dipshits of the Crusades knew how to handle a situation. Even though they didn't always win, they were brutal and ruthless enough that they won most of the time. Well, that's about it for today. I'm wearing out with all this tremendously good news. Good news! Things are falling apart. Monuments are falling down. Jews are unhappy. Everybody's unhappy. Nobody wants to kick ass and take names. All want to sit around and cry, cry, cry. I got a song about that, country song. I forget the whole name of the tune. But I'm out of here, baby. 14:5 and 5 words. Just protect your ass. Don't worry much about anybody else's ass. Your ass, your family's ass. And you might live till the real bloodletting starts. To be perfectly honest, if they want to get the Muslims out of here, or anybody else, just do in all the top capitalists in this country and the big bankers. And do them all in on a weekend, and boy, I'll tell you, they'll have these goddamn Muslims out of here in 5 seconds.
Life is just a bowl of cherries. Don't take it serious. Life's too mysterious. You work, you slave, you worry so, but you can't take your dough when you go, go, go. Keep repeating, it's the berries. The strongest oak must fall. The best things in life to you were just long. So how can you lose what you never own? Life is just a bowl of cherries, so live and laugh at it all. Keep repeating, it's the berries. You know the strongest oak has got a fall. The sweet things in life just long. So how can you lose what you never lost? Life is just a bowl of cherries. So live it, love it. Wiggle your ears.